This will be Thought Police Part 2. Last week's message, we basically took an article out of the Newsweek magazine, December 24th, 1990, and basically took an article within that Newsweek and basically tore it apart, looked at it, examined it in light of truth and in light of the Scriptures, and especially examining it because within that article, as I pointed out in last week's message, the enemies, maybe I should say, of Christianity and of what we know as the American way and so forth and so on, that they have revealed some of their plans that they plan or that they are in the process of carrying out in this country. And of course, as we will see, have been carrying out for some time. Let me, in the beginning of this message, review some of what was found in this Newsweek magazine and in this particular article, and use that as an introduction to where we want to go with this particular message. The front of the Newsweek magazine, again, as I showed you last week, it has the big letters Thought Police, as if carved into cement. And it's above that it says, Watch What You Say. The actual article that we examined is entitled Taking Offense. Is this the new enlightenment on campus or the new McCarthyism? Now, basically, this article begins by describing experiments that are taking place across the university campuses today. And let me just read the paragraph that deals with that in review. Paragraph number 2, it says, There is an experiment of sorts taking place in American colleges, or more accurately, hundreds of experiments at different campuses directed at changing the consciousness of this entire generation of university students. The goal is to eliminate prejudice, not just the petty sort that shows up on sophomore dorm walls, but the grand prejudice that has ruled American universities since their founding, that the intellectual tradition of Western Europe occupies the central place in the history of civilization. In this context, it would not be enough for a student to refrain from insulting homosexuals or minorities. He or she would be expected to affirm their presence on campus and to study their literature and culture alongside that of Plato, Shakespeare, and Locke. This agenda is broadly shared by most organizations of minority students, feminists, and gays. Now, they admit that there are experiments going across, hundreds of experiments taking place on university campuses right now across this land. The question is, well, why would they want to do that? They say, well, it's to eliminate prejudice and to do those kinds of things. But could there be a plan for that that's much broader than what they state in this particular article? Why would they want to perform these experiments? Well, I believe we found the answer when we read Bertrand Russell's statement that he made or that he wrote some time back. Let me read again the quote that I shared with you in last week's message from Bertrand Russell. Quote, I think the subject which will be of most importance is mass psychology. It may be hoped that in time anybody will be able to persuade anybody of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with money and equipment. This subject will make great strides when it is taken up by scientists under a scientific dictatorship. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for a generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies and policemen. It's that last statement in that quote that I want you to pay special attention to, or kind of log back in the back of your mind as we continue on in this message, because I think it becomes even more pertinent as we continue, as we go further into this message. This article basically describes, for the most part, it deals with what they called PC, which is defined as, or stands for, politically correct. And it gave different examples of what they mean by being politically correct thoughts, politically correct statements, politically correct writings, and of course it would definitely infer politically correct actions as well. But for example, in the area of thought and speech, an example of being politically correct is using the term differently abled rather than disabled for someone, for example, in a wheelchair or something of that kind. Another example they used was in the spelling of woman, spelled W-O-M-Y-N is politically correct rather than W-O-M-A-N. A-N or E-N. And then they also use the examples of that which is politically correct being students of color rather than colored students. Now, those were examples that were given for politically correct statements, thinking, so forth. If there are politically correct, then there is obviously just the opposite as well. And it's what I will term in this message PI, or politically incorrect, according to those who want this change in politically correct thinking. They would also have what would be termed politically correct. And we showed some examples in last week's message of what is politically incorrect according to these people as well. There was one specifically in this article that really stands out, especially in the statement that's made. I don't know if you remember from last week when I read about Professor Vincent Cerek of the University of California, Berkeley. It is, as we see in this particular incident, it is politically incorrect for a professor to reveal scientific data, whether truth or not. It's politically incorrect to reveal scientific data which demonstrates differences between the races. Let me read the statement that was made about and by this Professor Vincent Cerek. Paragraph 9 of this article. It says he holds, talking about, of course, Professor Cerek, it says he holds scientifically controversial views about the relationship of brain size to intelligence, which tend toward the politically unthinkable conclusion that some races could have a genetic edge in intellect. He does not, however, bring these up in his introductory course. As an anthropologist, Cerek knows exactly what happened to him. He stumbled on a taboo. Quote, "There are subjects you don't even talk or think about," end quote, he said, or Cerek says, among them, quote, "race, gender, and homosexuality," end quote. Now notice, I didn't pick this up when I brought this out in last week's message, but I want you to see something here that I think is of interest, or at least pick up on something that's hidden here. It says that he holds scientifically controversial views about relationship of brain size to intelligence, which tend toward the politically unthinkable conclusion that some races could have a genetic edge in intellect. You know, that is only a true statement if you're talking about, if it is dealing only with one particular race. That's only politically incorrect if the scientific data, which it does, shows that because of brain size, the white race has an edge intellectually over the black race or the other races. You know, if the scientific data showed or proved that the black race had the edge, you know they'd be teaching it. And you know nobody or nearly nobody would raise up and declare that they stop or declare that it would be politically incorrect to do so. So keep that in mind as we think about that example. You know, they decide what is prejudiced and what is not prejudiced, as we pointed out in last week's message. I also shared, not from within the article itself, but I also shared an example that it's politically incorrect for a high school teacher, for example, to present facts which would raise doubts about the accuracy of the 6 million figure of the Holocaust. I don't know if you remember the Aurora, Colorado Hinckley High School teacher. Not only that did that, but not only did she do that, it was even politically incorrect for her even to suggest to the class that there are people who do question that figure. It was wrong for her to even raise a doubt in their mind by sharing with them that there's people who oppose that particular figure of the Holocaust. Another example we used is that it showed that it's politically incorrect for the chief editor, or that it was politically incorrect for the chief editor of the Dead Sea Scrolls to share his personal views about the religion of Judaism. Even though he declared, I don't dislike Jews, he just happened to share what he believes about the religion of Judaism. And it was politically incorrect for him, or in this day and age, it would be politically correct for just about anybody to do that, unless, of course, your comments about Judaism were positive. And his, of course, were not. The article goes on through it to reveal, it reveals the experiments were for the purpose or what the experiments were for. It reveals what the experiments basically were for. Now, it doesn't come out boldly and say what they were for, but it definitely is proven within the article what the experiments were for, what the purpose of the experiments were for, and that being for brainwashing and the subsequent mind control of the next generation. It was a perfect illustration within this article that proves that that's exactly what these experiments are for. It was found in paragraph 12. And let me read the sentences. Let me basically read this whole paragraph again. It says, one of the most controversial PC initiatives took place at the University of Texas at Austin, where the English faculty recently chose a new text for the freshman composition course, which is required for about half the entering undergraduates. Up until now, instructors had been free to assign essays on a range of topics for students to read and discuss. Henceforth, all readings will be from the anthology called Racism and Sexism, an Integrated Study by Paula S. Rothenberg. The selections, some of which are excellent, comprise a primer of PC thought. In the first chapter, Rothenberg answers what many white men wonder but few dare ask, why are they the only ones ever accused of racism or sexism? The sine qua non of racism and sexism, Rothenberg explains, is subordination, which in Western society is exercised only by whites over blacks and men over women. Hence, reverse racism and sexism by definition do not exist. Now, Professor Alan Gribben was one of the minority who objected to this approach of teaching composition. He derided the course as, quote, oppression studies, end quote. By dictating the content of readings, he charged the department, quote, presumes that content is the most important thing about the writing course, end quote. But that is just the point. In the context of PC, political content is the most important thing about everything. So very clearly, here's a great example where a composition course that is supposed to be, its primary purpose is to be teaching people how to write, how to compose, is all of a sudden changed around, and its primary purpose becomes the tool to brainwash these students in the line of thinking that the university or those who are even maybe behind the university want their thinking to be. You know, if it was known, this has already, for the most part, been accomplished in the last three or four generations. All that is happening on the campus today is simply the continued progression of the same thing. You know, basically, let me divert a little bit from our review here. Basically, we have been living in an era of brainwashing, mind manipulation, and mind control. Let me read again from the book, The Art of Psychopolitics. I read from this a couple messages back, but let me do it again in relation to this particular message. Really, it was those other messages that kind of generated my thinking to preach on this one as well as this article. Let me first read from the introduction of this book. It says, the booklet you are about to read is an English paraphrase of a red communist textbook used both in Russia and in America to train communist agents in the art of deceiving non-communists with words and with false precepts. The textbook spells out methods which secret communists use to alter the loyalties of American citizens and then use those citizens, especially those in government positions, to take control of the nation. It describes these ingenious and effective methods of mind control called psychiatry and psychology, which are promoted as forms of mental healing. Needless to say, the Reds do not want Christian Americans to know these are false sciences by which they gain control of the minds of the people. Now, this particular course took place, the writing comes from the 1950s. So we can start to see that within this era of time, there was plans for brainwashing. Now, let me read right from this Russian textbook, Psychopolitics. Let me just read from page 10, which, again, from their own words, describes what psychopolitics is. Psychopolitics is the art and science of asserting and maintaining dominion over the thoughts and loyalties of individuals, officers, bureaus, and masses, and the effecting of the conquest of enemy nations through mental healing, or brainwashing and mind control. Now, let me also go, as I did in a couple previous messages, Let me now go to the protocols, because I found it especially interesting in light of psychopolitics that that protocols has so much to say about the need and the practice of brainwashing too. Of course, the protocols go back much further. They go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, somewhere in that early time frame. It was published in 1905, believed to be the transcription of the speeches given at the first Zionist Congress in, I believe, in Switzerland. Anyway, let me read from The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, book which basically shows their designs upon their designs in within their plans of a takeover of different countries. Let me read to begin by reading protocol from protocol number 3 in article 10. Just the first sentence. It says, "The Goyim have lost the habit of thinking unless prompted by the suggestions of our specialist." Now, that was way back then. They were already claiming that to be. How much more so today? You know, our people, boy, it is so evident, our people cannot think, for the most part, unless prompted and told how to think on different subjects. This war that's going on right now in the Middle East is certainly proof that our people are only thinking about that war, for the most part, the way those behind it intend them to think. Let's go to Protocol 5 now. Protocol 5 and Article 7 and 11. In Article 7, it says, "Nowadays it is more important to disarm the peoples than to lead them into war, more important to use for our advantage the passions which have burst into flames than to quench their fire, more important to catch up and interpret the ideas of others to suit ourselves than to eradicate them. The principal object of our directorate consists in this: to debilitate the public mind by criticism, to lead it away from serious reflections calculated to arouse resistance, to distract the forces of the mind towards a sham fight of empty eloquence." And then from Article 11 of this same protocol, it says, "There is nothing more dangerous than personal initiative. If it has genius behind it, such initiative can do more than can be done by millions of people among whom we have sown discord. We must so direct the education of the Goyim communities that whenever they come upon a matter requiring initiative, they may drop their hands in despairing impotence." Notice the mind again, the mind control, what for what purpose? To control and to subdue. Let's go to protocol number 9. Protocol number 9 in Article 10. It says, "We have fooled, bemused, and corrupted the youth of the Goyim by rearing them in principles and theories which are known to us to be false, although it is by us that they have been inculcated." Now to protocol number 16. Protocol 16 and Articles 1 and 8, or at least parts of each of those. Article number 1, first sentence reads, "In order to effect the destruction of all collective forces except ours, we shall emasculate the first stage of collectivism, the universities, by re-educating them in a new direction." And then jump down to protocol or Article 8. It says, "In a word, knowing by the experience of many centuries that people live and are guided by ideas, that these ideas are imbibed by people only by the aid of education provided with equal success for all ages of growth, but of course by varying methods, we shall swallow up and confiscate to our own use the last scintilla of independence of thought, which we have for long past been directing towards subjects and ideas useful for us. The system of bridling thought is already at work in the so-called system of teaching by object lessons, the purpose of which is to turn the Goyim into unthinking, submissive brutes, waiting for things to be presented before their eyes in order to form an idea of them." So very clearly, there have been designs from way back upon us as a people to brainwash us, to take over, to perpetuate mind control and subdue us as a result. It's really taking place at this point in time from all angles. It's taking place right now at the hands of communist as we can see from what I've just read from these two books, from communist infiltration and influence, at the hands of Judaism's influence and infiltration. It's taking place at the hands of religion today, specifically Judeo-Christianity. It's taking place at the hands of our government, specifically the legislative and judicial branches. It's taking place, maybe most thoroughly through our public education system. It's taking place through the rewriting of history. It's taking place through the media, television and Hollywood. It's taking place through popular music, and let's just not blame rock, but through let's understand it for the way it is, both through rock music and country western music. It's taking place through the fluoridation of our water, and it's taking place through dialectical materialism, and I'm certainly through other means as well. Now, somebody could hear all of that and say, and just respond by saying, that sounds hopeless. How in the world can we escape from the influence of this brainwashing from all these different angles that they're coming at us? Well, hang on, because I believe I'm going to give you a way to combat it at the end of this message. Paul Bunch, I think, came up with a perfect example or a perfect cartoon for what's taking place through all of these different means and the brainwashing of Americans and certainly the world in some respects too. It's called A Recipe for a Mind-Controlled American. And here's the recipe. It says, choose a tender young American, stir in 2,652 hours of TV a year for several years until eyes glaze over. Combine with 50 gallons of opiate of religion, 20 gallons of superstition, and just a pinch of truth, being careful not to spank. Cover and cook for 10 years. Dump in 500 decibels of rock music, 1,000 gallons of booze, and thousands of dollars worth of drugs. Sprinkle Antichrist propaganda evenly over entire mess until it turns red. Then baste with big lie juice. Bring to a boil, cover, and let simmer. Serves one world humanist government obediently. That certainly describes very well what is, at least to a degree, what is taking place upon our people today. The last paragraph of this article, getting back now to the article and our basic review, the last paragraph of this article, I really believe, describes the purpose of these experiments. Now, as I wrote that down yesterday in preparation for this morning's message, I realized that I had fallen prey to PC, to politically correct terminology. All of a sudden, I realized that they had said that they're in this article, that there are experiments going on across the American colleges today, and all of a sudden I realized experiment is the wrong word. That's a politically correct word. They wouldn't dare say, even though they do reveal it through the article for those who have eyes to see and ears to hear, they reveal, but they don't want to use what the right words or the right terminology to really explain what they're doing on college campuses today. They are not experimenting. Let me prove that by going again to Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary and define the word experiment, or look at the definition for the word experiment. Experiment is defined as 1A as being a test or a trial, B as tentative procedure or policy, C an operation carried out under controlled conditions in order to discover an unknown effect. Now let me assure you right now that none of that is what is going on in college campuses today. That is not a test or a trial or a tentative procedure or policy or operation carried out in order to discover an unknown effect. They know exactly the effect they want to accomplish. You know, they admitted they wanted to, first of all, use their quote-unquote experiments to get rid of prejudice. They weren't, an experiment would be to discover what effect is going to come out of all of this and determine whether that's the way you want to go then. Well, these aren't experiments going on in our college campuses. What's going on in the universities today, or the universities are being used, as they have in the past, they are being used as seed beds or spawning grounds for the continued manipulation and control of the next generation. It's not experiments at all. So we need to understand that. The last paragraph, anyway, goes on, I believe, reveals the purpose for these quote-unquote experiments that are going on campuses today. Let me read that to you. It says, yes, of course, conflict is inevitable as the university makes the transition somewhat ahead of the rest of society. Notice there it admits to it as well. This is a transition, not an experiment, but a transition that is to happen before the rest of society, or before it actually happens in the rest of society. Let me begin again. Yes, of course, conflict is inevitable as the university makes the transition somewhat ahead of the rest of society toward its multi-ethnic future. There are, in fact, some who recognize the tyranny of PC, but see it only as a transitional phase.
which will no longer be necessary once the virtues of tolerance are eternalized. Does that sound familiar? It's the dictatorship of the proletariat to be followed by the withering away of the state. These should be interesting years. Notice it used the term multi-ethnic future. I believe within that last paragraph it describes the purpose behind what's going on in the college campuses. Its purpose being that the universities are simply a means to an end, or not an end in themselves, but a means to an end, and that is to a totally pluralistic society. Now, that's where I ended in last week's message. But I also ended with that statement along with a question. And the question being, is there an even greater purpose behind all of this as well? The rest of this message, let me share with you what I believe is the greater plan and the means of achieving it behind all that's going on in public education on the college campuses and in other places. Now, we ended with the thought of pluralism, or that article basically was talking about trying to obtain a totally pluralistic society. Since we ended there, let me talk about pluralism to begin with. Matter of fact, let me talk about the origin of pluralism. Where did this pluralistic mindset that we have so prevalent in today's society, that wasn't a part of this country's beginnings, where does the pluralistic thinking, that mindset, originate from? Well, someone has admitted where it comes from. Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum, who wrote in the introduction, who was one of the writers for the introduction to Leonard Yassin's book, The Jesus Connection, wrote this. He said, Leonard Yassin's compelling thesis regarding the possibilities of genuine reconciliation between Christians and Jews, and ultimately between all members of God's human family, is based on the Jewish doctrine of the nations of the world, which today we might well call the Jewish doctrine of pluralism and world community, end quote. Interesting, huh? All of a sudden, this Jewish rabbi says that the whole idea of pluralism is the result of Jewish doctrine, Jewish thinking. It originates with them. Now, let me assure you that the word pluralism is also a PC word. It's a politically correct term. They wouldn't dare tell us what they really mean by pluralism. Because, listen, I want to give you what the real meaning behind pluralism. And since they say that it's Jewish doctrine, let me give you Jewish quotes to prove to you what is really meant by the Jews by the word pluralism. The Jewish world, a quote I've used certainly in other messages in the past, begins to give us the answer. And I want to use it again in light of this message because it fits in here so well. What is the real meaning behind pluralism? Jewish world, February 9th, 1883, begins to give us the answer. It says, quote, the great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teachings, and that in a universal brotherhood of nations, Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum use? He talked about based on the Jewish doctrine of the nations of the world. And then he said the Jewish doctrine of pluralism and world community. What was written in the Jewish world? It says the great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teachings, and that in a universal brotherhood of nations, listen, a greater Judaism, in fact, all the separate races and religions shall disappear. That's their idea, or at least the beginning of their idea of what pluralism is. That not that we have a pluralistic society with everyone accepted. No, instead, to see the other religions, and even as we'll see, races disappear so that there's only one religion left, and that being what they called a greater Judaism. Now let me reveal to you, not through what I think or believe happen to teach, but instead again through they themselves admitting what their plans are. Let me show you how they intend to see this accomplished, and it certainly puts a greater light on what pluralism is all about, or at least what they mean by pluralism, what they intend by this thing called pluralism. This will be a quote from Rabbi Emanuel Rabinowitz. It's a speech that
he allegedly made before the Emergency Council of European Rabbis in Budapest, Hungary, on January 12, 1952. This is part of his speech. He said, "We will openly reveal our identity with the races of Asia and Africa. I can state with assurance that the last generation of white children is now being born. Our control commissions will, in the interest of peace and wiping out interracial tensions, forbid the whites to mate with whites. The white women must cohabit with members of dark races, and the white men with black women. Thus, the white race will disappear, for mixing the dark with the white means the end of the white man, and our most dangerous enemy will become only a memory. We shall embark upon an era of 10,000 years of peace and plenty, the Pax Judaica, and our race will rule undisputed over the earth. Our superior intelligence will easily enable us to retain mastery over the world of the dark peoples." End quote. Note that part of the plan in accomplishing what they mean by pluralism is the elimination of the white race. Let's take it a step further, not only through the elimination of the white race, but through something else as well. Bernard Lazare, another quote that I've shared with you in past messages, Bernard Lazare, in the book La Antisemitism, on page 350, made this statement. He said, quote, "The Jew is not satisfied with de-Christianizing. He Judaizes. He destroys Catholic or Protestant faith. He provokes indifference, but he imposes his idea of the world, of morals and of life, upon those whose faith he ruins. He works at his age-old task, the annihilation of the religion of Christ." End quote. How is this pluralism intended to be carried out? How is it to finally find its fulfillment? Not in all races cohabiting together without any quote-unquote racism or prejudice. No, by the destruction of the white race and Christianity. This is for extra. Note how the Jews make white and Christian synonymous terms. They want to destroy the white race. They want to destroy Christianity. To the Jew, those two terms are synonymous. Why? You know, somebody might ask, why are they so anti-white? Well, the reason is because they know that the white man's religion is Christianity. If I believe, I sincerely believe, that if Christianity was the black man's religion, his natural religion, if they were Israel, which of course they are not, we know that the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, Kindred peoples are Israel, and here's proof of it, then because of that, their religion is Christianity. But if it was the black race, or the Chinese race, I'll guarantee you that would be the race that the Jews would want to destroy most. Why? Because Christianity would be their religion as being Israel. That makes sense? You see the connection there that takes place? I hope so. You know, they're admitting that we're Israel. It's just it's the age-old battle between Esau, Edom, trying to get back the birthright from Jacob, Israel. That's why Jews hate whites. And probably most specifically Germans, as we'll see, because the Germans, it appears to be, through history and archaeology, appear to be from the tribe of Judah. And that's why the Jews hate the Germans with such vehemence. They're anti-white. They're specifically anti-white Christian. And as we know, they're especially white identity Christian, because the identity Christians today are the ones who are revealing who true Israel is, starting to wake the people up to their identity and their responsibility before God. And it certainly helps you understand where the Jews are, and they don't want that known. That's all for extra. Let there be no doubt about it. The final objection of all that's taking place in the campuses and throughout society today, with the Jewish power behind it, is the destruction of white Christianity. At least those unwilling to be brainwashed. If you're willing to be brainwashed, you can become an obedient slave. But if you're not willing to become brainwashed, I guarantee you are the target for elimination. Basically, if you're unwilling to be brainwashed, you're considered a cancer that must be eliminated, as so well proven by New Age leader, Jewess Barbara Marx Hubbard, when she stated here just a few years back, quote, "We the elders," who are the elders? Remember the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, the Jews? "We the elders have been patiently waiting until the very last moment to take action to cut out this corrupted and corrupting element in the body of humanity." What is she talking about? She goes on, "It is like watching a cancer grow. Something must be done before the whole body is destroyed.
The destructive one-fourth must be eliminated from the social body. Fortunately, you dearly beloveds, of course, her fellow New Agers she's speaking to, are not responsible for this act. We are, who? The elders. We are in the charge of God's selection process for planet Earth. He selects, we destroy. We are the riders of the pale horse death. We come to bring death to those who are unable to know God. Of course, they're speaking of their God, not ours. We do this for the sake of the world. End quote. Well, who do they have in mind? Who is this cancer that's amongst the populace? Well, Global 2000 proponent and New Ager Steve Munford makes it very clear in the Humanist magazine of January-February issue of 1981, when he wrote, quote, "Our epoch will certainly see the end of the disease of Christianity," end quote. Now, let me state that that is, without a doubt, their final objective, the destruction of white Christianity. But they're not so bold at this stage in time to carry that out literally yet. They know that certainly probably some of the rest of the world as well, European communities, but the American and European communities are certainly not yet to the point where they would allow them to carry out that final goal that they have in mind for white Christianity. So they have to instill steps along the way, steps of brainwashing to get society to that point. They're not so bold to take that final step yet, so they have an alternate plan at this point in history. And that alternate plan is so well described in that article that we centered in on in last week's message. That alternate plan being the institution or the legislation of hate crimes, and then those to be carried out through thought police. Thought crimes being enforced through hate laws and thought police. All of that is simply the means to their end, and let's keep that in mind. What they want to do now, what they are telling us, basically, through all of this, is that we will not only tell you what are proper and improper actions, not only that, but also what are proper and improper thoughts. You know, somebody's thought crimes, that's what we're talking about. And somebody's certainly going to respond. I'm sure there'd be people out there, the majority of the people today, who have no idea what's going on, no idea what they have fallen prey to, and they're going to say, thought crimes? You have got to be kidding. It can't happen here. Not with free speech guaranteed by the Constitution. It just can't happen. Oh, yeah? Well, let me assure you it's happening. 1988, the Jewish Anti-Defamation League sponsored a nationwide law student competition to write a model anti-hate law for America. A law, listen carefully, a law which would make illegal thoughts or statements, not just actions anymore. Now all of a sudden thoughts and statements become illegal. And then it says, which might lead, not which only lead, but which might lead to racial violence. You think, oh, that can't happen. That could never happen. That was just a contest and sharpen the law students' abilities to make laws. It can't happen. You listen carefully. Shared this before, but let me share it again. This is a newspaper clipping taken from the Casper Herald from the week of January 28th to February 30th, 1990. The title of this clipping is Four Prefiled Bills Aimed at Hate Groups. Begins, Cheyenne AP, four bills aimed at restricting the activities of white supremacist organizations or, quote, hate groups, end quote. Notice who becomes the hate groups. Hate groups, very clearly, are only white people, only white groups, quote, unquote, white supremacist organizations. Only white people can be hate groups. Black people can't. Black supremacist organizations can't be hate groups. They very clearly show who they intend this to mean. Okay, it says, have been pre-filed for the legislators' upcoming budget session. This, of course, is in Wyoming. Senator Kelly Mader, Republican of Campbell, the sponsor of two of the measures, said he filed his measures in an effort to strengthen current state laws and provide for more severe penalties. So there's laws already in the book. They want to make them stronger. A little bit later in this article, it says, another measure sponsored by Senator Liz Byrd, Democrat of Laramie, would make malicious harassment a misdemeanor unless it results in injury, in which case it would be a felony. And then this last one especially, I want you to key in on. It says the fourth measure, sponsored by
a representative, Guy Cameron, Democrat of Laramie, would allow law enforcement agencies to take action against white supremacist groups that might be involved in military training before they are established. What was the competition all about? It was a competition. It was to come up with a law which would make illegal thoughts or statements which might lead to racial violence. The fourth measure, again, sponsored by Representative Guy Cameron, Democrat of Laramie, would allow law enforcement agencies to take action against white supremacist groups that might be involved in military training before they are established. Quote, the key is that you can get at them earlier in the game so we don't have something terrible happen that results in injury or death, he said. Thought crimes. And the enforcement through thought police or through the hate laws. It can't happen, people. It is happening. It's already in motion. Now, let me point out, there's something else that's interesting that's brought out about this law student competition, and that is the fact that who sponsored it? It was the Jewish Anti-Defamation League. Let me assure you, there's nothing new under the sun. As proven by the fact that there's nothing new about Jews being behind such things, stirring up such actions. Let's turn to Acts chapter 17. In Acts chapter 17, verses 5 through 9 to begin with, it says, But the Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob and set the city in an uproar, and coming upon the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. And when they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city authorities, shouting, These men who have upset the world, or King James, turned the world upside down, have come here also. And Jason has welcomed them, and they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Yahshua. And they stirred up the crowd and the city authorities who heard these things. Notice, they stirred up the crowds. Why? Because someone would dare claim Yahshua is king instead of Caesar. And then jump down to verse 13, it says, But when the Jews of Thessalonica found out that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul and Berea also, they came there likewise, agitating and stirring up the crowds. Nothing new about what's going on today in regards to hate laws. They didn't want anybody then worshiping Christ and revealing and preaching truth, and they certainly don't want it to happen today. So you'll find that the Jews are behind these hate laws. And let me give you an example of an ADL, not only ADL encouraged law student competition, but ADL assisted anti-hate legislation. This comes out of a special printing from the National Prayer Network in Oregon City that's called Would Anti-Hate Laws Make You a Lawbreaker? Let me read a portion of this concerning legislation that was at that time then being put into force. It says, here are the specifics of the ADL-assisted anti-hate legislation now before Congress. The first one is called the Hate Crime Statistics Act. It was H.R. 1048. The author of it was Republican John Conyers, Jr. of Michigan. Or I think that's Representative John Conyers. Anyway, it says the Hate Crime Statistics Act would require states to determine if crimes committed under their jurisdiction were motivated by prejudice. These would include serious crimes, but also such relatively minor offenses as vandalism, trespass, and threat. States would be required to relay such information to a federal anti-hate data bank, then to be shared with law enforcement officials throughout the nation. Notice again the control here. Thus, if a homosexual were the victim of an offense as minor as vandalism, trespass, or threat, states would first be forced to determine if the offense were motivated by prejudice, a tedious task. If so, details of the homosexual's case would be forwarded to the federal government. If the person or group who committed the crime had not yet been found, the government's policy of sharing information concerning the case with state and local agencies might help to apprehend such persons. Thus, the long arm of the federal government could come to the aid of a homosexual victim in a way that would be out of the question for victims of crimes not motivated by prejudice. In other words, this Hate Crime Statistics Act makes crimes, thought crimes, of greater importance to the government than actual crimes of violence. Interesting. Let me give you the kind of what happened with that bill. On May 18, 1989, House Subcommittee on Criminal Justice gave it unanimous approval. And a companion bill in the Senate, S-419, was automatically approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee on March 9, 1989. And let me give you an update.
there obviously these things are taking place. These laws, this legislation is being put in and even enforced. Let me give you an update where things are at right now. As of last October, 21 states had passed hate laws. Of course, we also know about the Genocide Treaty. I didn't put this in my notes, but it just came to mind. The Genocide Treaty was used, is also a treaty for that very same purpose of making it a not only a national crime, of for thought crimes and that kind of thing to be a national crime, but even an international crime so that we can be taken before international courts. But not only that, let me update it right up to this previous week. I don't know how many of you heard President Bush's 1991 State of the Union address, but in that address, just one little short statement, he made it clear in his mind that there is a need for, quote, vigorous enforcement, end quote, against racism, quote, racism, bigotry, and hate, end quote. Now let me ask you a question. That brings us right up to now. Bush intends for more laws to be instated in this area, more thought crimes. Couldn't happen in America. Could happen in communist Russia, certainly. But people are saying it couldn't happen in America. People, it's time to wake up. It's happening. It's here. Now let me ask you, in relation to what President Bush said, when he stated that there is a need for more, quote, vigorous enforcement, end quote, of against, quote, racism, bigotry, and hate, end quote. Who did President Bush have in mind as the perpetrators of these crimes? Let me ask you. Was it Jews? Was it the blacks? Was it Hispanics or Orientals or even Arabs today? No, you know as well as I do that it was none of these. And so does the rest of America. If they think about it, they know that he is specifically talking about white people. They are laws intended to deal with and suppress and control and subdue white people. Do you think there's any question that he had in mind? Do you think that he had in mind or would even consider ever applying such stricter laws to somebody like Eli Weisel, the one-time Nobel Peace Prize recipient? And that's about as big a joke as Gorbachev receiving it this last year. Eli Weisel said these words. He said, quote, every Jew somewhere in his being should set apart a zone of hate, healthy, viral hate, for what the German personifies and for what persists in the German, end quote. You know, why shouldn't, if he's going to instruct hate laws, why shouldn't somebody like Eli Weisel be under it? Well, because it's not intended for that race of people. It is intended for one race of people, white Christianity. And by the way, let me state here that what Eli Weisel was talking about, it was stated in the sense of being relative to the Holocaust, and some people would say, well, it's okay for them to hate because what happened to them in the Holocaust, quote-unquote. Well, let me tell you, it has nothing to do with the Holocaust because we know that that is nothing but a hoax to begin with. But what they're talking about, what the German personifies and what persists in the German, what they hate so much is the Israelite blood that runs through their veins. And Esau Edom hates Israel. And they hate the Germans specifically again because it is pretty clear that the Germans are Judah. And Judah was given the scepter. They were the ruling tribe. Now, Bush certainly did not have Eli Weisel in mind, or as he didn't have blacks, Hispanics, or any of the other races. He had the white man specifically in mind when he spoke of that. You know, hate laws, without a question, are aimed primarily at whites and specifically, even more so, at white identity Christianity. In spite of the fact that statistics prove that interracial violence is primarily perpetrated by non-whites. William Wilbanks, professor of criminal justice at Florida International University, authored a book entitled The Myth of Racist Criminal Justice System. And in that, he shares statistics that prove absolutely that it is not the whites who are primarily committing racial crimes, but just the opposite. He states in there, in 1985, 629,000 interracial crimes were recorded. And then he says 9 out of 10 of them were committed by blacks against whites. White criminals, 98% of the time, prey on other whites to rape, rob, and assault.
Black criminals chose fellow blacks as victims less than half the time. Black criminals seemed to prefer attacking white people. While only 2% of the victims chosen by white criminals are black, more than 50% of the victims targeted by black criminals to rape, rob, and assault are white. So then why? If that is the case, if statistics prove that racism is not, for the most part, a white crime, but instead a black crime or a crime of the other races, why are the whites targeted? Well, I think our article last week began to show us why they're targeted. And that is because they fear, and you can determine who the they are here, because they fear the whites. Why? Because they know that Christian Israel will someday prevail over their enemies. Turn with me. I'm sure they know Malachi chapter 4 just as well as Christianity Today. Matter of fact, they probably know it better than Christianity Today for the most part, because the majority of modern Christianity wouldn't think of going to Malachi 4 and still applying it for some time yet to happen. Listen to Malachi 4 and listen to what it says. For verses 1 through 3. Let's go to 1 through 3. It says, "For behold, the day is coming, burning like a furnace, and every evildoer will be chaff. And the day that is coming will set them ablaze, says Yahweh of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings, and you will go forth and skip about like calves from the stall. And you will tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under your souls, under the soles of your feet, on the day which I am preparing, says Yahweh of hosts." Verse 4 as well, "Remember the law of Moses, my servant, even the statutes and ordinances," should be judgments there, "the statutes and judgments which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel." They understand that Christian Israel will someday prevail over their enemies, and most specifically over Esau Edom, as described in a parallel prophecy to Malachi 4 in Obadiah verses 17 and 18, where it says, "Then the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. Then the house of Jacob will be a fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau." What did Malachi 4 say? It said they tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under their souls. Who is it speaking of? Who are the wicked described as in Malachi 4, as found in Obadiah 17 and 18? Esau Edom, who will be ashes under the feet of Jacob Israel. You know, they have a fear of white Christians, and rightfully so, according to this passage. Not only that, remember in the article it described their fear of even dead whites? God always provides. This cartoon happened to come across my desk just this week, and it fits so well in with both last week's message as well as this one. It's an article found in the Birmingham Post-Herald, Friday, September 21st, 1990. The article is "Cure is Needed for Anti-Semitism," with this cartoon underneath. And by the way, this is not a cartoon some of our people drew. This is a cartoon that they drew, a cartoon by Ed Stein of the Rocky Mountain News. The cartoon is a picture of a cemetery. And there's two or three or four headstones that have the Jewish six-pointed star on them. And then there's one headstone right in the middle that has anti-Semitism written across it. And out of the grave is reaching a skeleton hand that's reaching over as if to grasp and strangle the headstone, or whoever's in the grave, of the six-pointed star. Now, if they only knew how true that was. But first, before I go into that, let me decode what is really being said there. That is all PC, politically correct, for people to hear. And nobody today would challenge this picture. And by the way, the title over this cartoon is called "Curse of the Undead." Interesting, is it not? Well, let me decode or translate this correctly, what's really going on here. They call it the curse of the undead. What it really is the fear of white Christian truth revealing Jewish hatred. That is really what decoded correctly. That's what that describes. And with that decoded or translated correctly, if they only knew how true that cartoon is. I immediately thought of the prophecy found in Ezekiel chapter 37. Ezekiel 37, where it discusses the valley of dry bones. Let me quickly read some of this to you. In Ezekiel 37, starting with verse 10, listen to what it says. It says, "So I prophesied as he commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they came to life and stood on their feet, an exceedingly great army." Now, this wasn't literally that dry bones were going to become an army. This was symbolic of something else. Could it be symbolic of a people that were ignorant of their roots, ignorant of their identity, a people asleep to themselves and to what God's plan for them was, a people asleep to what their enemies were doing to them? God raises them up as an army. Verse 11, "Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say our bones are dried up and our hope is perished. We are completely cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, Thus says the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves, my people, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am Yahweh, when I have opened your graves and caused you to come up out of your graves, my people. And I will put my spirit within you, and you will come to life, and I will place you in your own land. Then you will know that I, Yahweh, have spoken and done it, declares Yahweh." It describes a people that are all of a sudden awakened, who will deal with the enemies of Christ and Christianity as they are today. All of this, of course, is just a means to their real end, and that's the destruction of white Christianity. But at this point in time, they want to regulate your mind as a means to getting to that point. In other words, they want to take our minds and our thoughts captive. Now, why do they see this as so important? First of all, again, because it's a means to their final end. But also because they understand what Yahshua understood. In Matthew 15 and 19, Yahshua said, "For out of the heart," the heart was used in reference to the mind, says, "For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, and slanders." Remember Proverbs 23:7, it says, for as a man thinketh within himself, so he is." They understand that if you control the thinking of a man, you control the man. In a sense, he becomes a prisoner of war, for this is certainly a battle of the mind. Let there be no doubt that all of this begins with a battle of the mind. You see, there's nothing wrong with mind control if it's the right kind. You've got to quickly turn to 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 through 6. I'm about to run out of tape here, so you've got the passage if we don't get it covered. Chapter 10, and verses 3 through 6. It says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. We are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, and we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete." Let me now give you the answer to mind control. Mind control is the answer to mind control. A mind submitted unto God, as described in Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. And through what's stated there, we will be able to conquer and win. Romans 12, as we end, says, "I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." Let us win this battle, and it begins with mind control, with a surrendered mind, will,